is Shankar just taking a call at the start of a podcast?
I think that we didn't give him the house rules.
I know. Did you not get the housekeeping memo? Well, welcome back to another episode of GUcast. This is Declan Murphy, urologist at Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne. Hi, Renu. How are you?
Hello, I'm well. We're on the move again.
Renu Epen, urologist at Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne. Yes, we're on the move. We're not in our usual home. Do you want to tell everyone where we are?
Well, we're at the Windsor Hotel in Melbourne, one of the oldest hotels here, just opposite the Parliament Steps. Although our background really doesn't do justice to the the beautiful hotel that this is, but we are here.
We're in the,
you'll have to take
the Treasury boardroom, but the facade of this hotel, certainly by Australian standards, this is an old dame. This is a grand old dame of a hotel here in the city centre of Melbourne, just opposite the Parliament building. So nice to be here, somewhere different again.
Yeah, actually, you know, the longest memory I have of this place is the old cricketer's bar.
Yes.
Right on Spring Street.
Yeah, which is still there.
It's still there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And like all these things, I hadn't physically walked into this place for more than 3 years. And it's a place you would pop into from time to time to meet people. But it's back, like everything after COVID, slowly emerging. So nice to be here. But we're here to do one of our themed podcasts that we spoke about recently when we talked about how we're now doing partnerships in GUcast. And this is a themed podcast supported by our friends at Bayer Pharmaceuticals, who are silver partners of GUcast. And for this themed episode, we're going to be talking about one of our favorite topics, one of those fast-moving areas in the last few years in prostate cancer, non-metastatic or M0 CRPC, castration-resistant prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's right. Very exciting area, I think, in prostate cancer with, you know, real hope.
Yeah, and we certainly know from feedback from the audience who listens to GUcast, many of you are working in localized prostate cancer, but some of those patients will become metastatic, of course, and many of you are working in advanced prostate cancer, and of course, a large number of patients listen to the podcast. So hopefully, our discussion around this M0 CRPC area will be of interest to everybody. And we're theming it, it's a great themed one because we have a special guest in town tonight to do a talk.
Yes, absolutely, and everyone missed takes him for a medical oncologist, but we're claiming him. He is a urologist.
Yes. So, Professor Fred Saad, welcome back to Melbourne, Fred. Nice to see you. Yes. So, Fred, you're a urologist, of course, chief of urology and professor in Montreal. And we know you for very many years talking about prostate cancer and especially advanced prostate cancer because you've had a lifelong interest in this area. So, thanks for coming back to talk about this area tonight back in Melbourne.
Absolutely. It's a great time to be in the field. I mean, it's a great time for patients too. I mean, there's a lot more hope than when I started and we had only ADT to offer patients until they died.
Fantastic. Yeah. And also joining us, Dr. Louise Costas, friend of the podcast. Louise is a medical oncologist at Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre. Louise, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be back.
And also friend of the podcast, Associate Professor Shankar Siva, radiation oncologist. So a real multidisciplinary panel. Shankar, thanks for coming back and joining us.
Thanks for having me back. I might actually see you at the Cricketer's Arms afterwards for a beer.
We might just do that.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I mean, these guys are no strangers to the podcast. They've been on a couple of times.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah. We love the format. There's always more to come back for.
And more merchandise. Exactly.
And of course, this is a really classic multidisciplinary area, M0 CRPC. So, Fred, we thought we'd talk first of all about the how we get there with these patients. How does a patient end up being designated as being castration resistant but no evidence of metastases? What does that mean? And then we'll talk about what happens to those patients or what did happen before we suddenly emerged into this era where we had a really meaningful treatment to offer these patients.
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. You know, if people believe that early ADT makes sense for patients, this is how we reach to this state. So when we operate a patient, or, you know, God forbid, our radiation oncologists treat patients and they recur. I mean, I know none of us have ever seen this personally.
See, he's a urologist.
But it happens. We started with this. Yeah.
So, you know, when patients recur, and especially if they have fast doubling times, we usually will introduce ADT because we've got evidence that if we treat before the appearance of metastases, patients do better. But unfortunately, they can become castrate resistant even without the evidence of metastases. And evidence of metastases is based on conventional imaging. And that's what we need to be clear about. The definition doesn't change because you guys have led the world in PSMA. The definition of non-metastatic CRPC is based on CT and bone scan, and that's still the definition until today, until we decide that there's a better definition of that state of the disease.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's one of the areas we want to talk about is how you define these and the impact of novel imaging. But I think you're right for the start. We need to focus on conventional imaging because that's still the standard around the world. And it is the standard that has defined the trials that we'll speak about in a few moments. So if we could just ask you to talk about this sort of typical patient. There are three big trials that you're speaking about at the educational meeting tonight. And from my recollection, all these trials predominantly were patients who'd had previous treatment for prostate cancer, like a prostatectomy or radiation, I think maybe three quarters of them, but had relapsed and were then started on androgen deprivation therapy, often without any signs of metastases. That's something we probably don't do quite so much anymore, start patients on ADT without metastases.
Well, I'm surprised you say that, Declan, because I think around the world, if you've got a patient who recurs after surgery or radiation and you're watching them and the PSA is going up quickly, and you have algorithms and nomograms to predict time to metastases and death. And so we will often intervene with ADT before they become clearly metastatic to try to avoid or delay the metastases. So we do see a lot of those patients that are on ADT that are non-metastatic. And when they recur, then they're not all they're not homogeneous. And we base it on PSA doubling time because we have studies that we did to prevent metastases. And the placebo arms of those studies really helped us to define what is a high-risk non-metastatic CRPC. So that's important. We don't put them all in the same basket. Mm. If PSA is rising, you really have to look at the doubling time. And if it's under 10 months, those patients are at much higher risk of early metastases and early death. And those are the patients we put into the clinical trials. So we're not talking about the slow-rising PSA, where maybe there are opportunities to target lesions that we would pick up on PSMA or some other mode of imaging.
But Shankar, I might go back a step again to ask that question about how we get to the point of their PSA is rising, because patients we treat with a definitive radiotherapy for their prostate cancer and then a couple of years later the PSA is rising, maybe started on ADT without metastases, and good, the PSA goes down, but you've also started the clock ticking on castration-resistant prostate cancer. So what would you say is the approach nowadays for the patient with the rising PSA? Let's say they don't have any metastases. How are they managed?
Yeah, I think it really depends. It probably does depend on regionality as well. I think in tertiary cancer centres and specialist cancer centres, the pattern of practice will be quite different from the community. So, for example, there are a couple of studies actually potentially supporting earlier use of ADT. One is from Australia. There's a Trans-Tasman Radiation Oncology Group TOAD study, and another one from Canada as well. It's not strong evidence, in my opinion, but there is enough evidence to suggest that the timing of early androgen deprivation, even without metastatic disease, might be something that can be supported in the literature. So the community surgeon or radonc might elect to use earlier ADT than perhaps we might do in a quaternary centre, for example. So I think this population does still exist.
Yeah, I think that's what Fred's teaching me.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I think the message that we're trying to get across and you're trying to get across, Fred, is really important, because once these patients develop metastases, there is a significant impact on morbidity and their quality of life. So it's really important, I think, to be aggressive up front. And, you know, we're sort of moving that kind of pinpoint earlier and earlier, even when it's metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. But in this instant where it's NMCRPC, it's really important to be aggressive.
And Louise, can we ask you about this situation of patients who've got a rising PSA now for the first time? They've been on ADT maybe for a few years, not metastatic. What's your approach to those patients? How do you figure out which is the nice older patient whose PSA I can simply monitor versus here's a patient in whom I need to think about doing something?
Yeah, so I think the first thing, as Fred's mentioned, is looking at the PSA velocity and how quickly is the PSA doubling. And generally, PSA, obviously less than 10 months is sort of the landmark in terms of our PBS subsidisations and trial eligibility in Australia. But really, if it's doubling in less than 6 months, I'd be quite concerned about the aggressiveness of the prostate cancer and wanting to add an additional systemic therapy. Whereas if a patient's completely asymptomatic and it's doubling every year or so, they'd be the patients I'd be more inclined to just sit on and monitor. For patients who also have a fast doubling time and they don't have any clear metastatic disease on conventional imaging, a year ago when we didn't have any drugs available to give these patients or clinical trials, perhaps in that situation you'd think about novel imaging to see if perhaps M1 disease would then change their treatment options. But now we're lucky we do have some therapeutic options available for them.
So Louise, from a practical point of view, if you've got someone on ADT, what is your monitoring regime? How often do you check their PSA? How often do you do imaging?
So if they're just on ADT alone and feeling well, usually we'd review them every 3 months for clinical review, check how they're coping in terms of toxicity, and also check their PSA. In terms of imaging, we don't routinely do conventional imaging unless there's a reason to. So unless the patient develops concerning symptoms or if the PSA starts to rise, and then that would be the trigger to repeat imaging. But then you also have to monitor for all of the toxicity associated with androgen deprivation therapy as well. So look at their bone mineral density and sort of do a DEXA scan, say, every 2 years, and make sure you're looking at their lipid profile, the HbA1c, given they're at higher risk of cardiovascular disease. So that would factor into each 3 monthly review.
The problem, Fred, for these patients who their PSA is now rising, they're getting worried about it. There were no management options. And do you want to take us back to some of the earlier studies that you were very involved with that helped define the natural history of these M0 CRPCs? So we understand what's likely coming down the road for some of these patients, the high-risk ones, as Louise said, because some of these earlier studies were really what helped define the more recent pivotal studies of life-prolonging therapies.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, not so long ago, we really had no options for patients who were non-metastatic CRPC. And unfortunately, we didn't really know the natural history. So we had done trials with denosumab and zoledronic acid to try to prevent or delay bone metastases. And we included patients that had rising PSA, but really didn't know what the natural history was until the first pivotal trial with zoledronic acid that actually failed. Not because the drug wasn't effective, but because we didn't know the natural history. And we had estimated that patients would become metastatic within 18 months. And we took an all-comer population and realized it was actually 33 months because we made no distinction of absolute value or PSA doubling time. And from that study, we found out that, you know, 6 month doubling time was, you know, the very fast time to metastases and even death. And if patients had a doubling time, 18 months, it took over 3 years to become metastatic or die. So really, we have to stratify those patients. And those studies helped us. The denosumab study confirmed what we saw in the early zoledronic acid placebo arms of those studies. And so that established that the 10-month doubling time is where we should start to worry about patients. And that led to those three pivotal studies that really confirmed that if you can treat patients that are castration resistant early, and when we say early is in the micrometastatic state, let's not kid ourselves. Patients who have fast doubling times, PSA rising, they have something going on somewhere. It's just that we don't pick it up on conventional. And we've always known that earlier treatment seems to work better, and these trials actually confirm that.
And Louise, I suppose that's part of the lesson of the past 10 years in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, is these life-prolonging therapies, when you bring them earlier and earlier, not end stage, not just post-chemo, pre-chemo, etc., that we were seeing significant improvements in survival and quality of life for these patients. So that's what you've seen in your career, I'm sure, watching these AR pathway inhibitors come forward.
Definitely, yeah. I think the current theme in prostate cancer is really trying to move the needle forward and intensify treatment as early as possible. And the last 12 months, the focus has really been on intensifying treatment right at the start in metastatic hormone-sensitive disease. But it makes complete sense, I think, in non-metastatic castrate-resistant disease to also, you know, initiate treatment if it's available rather than waiting until there's visible metastases.
So that brings us right up to more recent times, and that's what Fred's here to tell us about.
Absolutely.
Is what are our therapy options for these poor patients with rising PSAs? They're now rising quickly. You've already told us that if we do nothing else, they're going to have bone metastases in a year and a half's time. But then no life-prolonging therapies in this area until, ta-da, these treatments came forward.
Yeah, and they didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, we had the patients that were treated post-chemo, as you mentioned, and then pre-chemo CRPC, and we were continuously doing better. So the next step was to introduce it even before the appearance of metastases in the castration-resistant setting. And what those three trials showed, amazingly, three consecutive trials showing that you can delay metastases by about 2 years, which was more than what we had expected when we designed the trials, against a placebo. And placebo was acceptable because there was no standard of care. So we compared it against doing nothing. And so that was already the primary endpoint, and that was enough to get approval. But I think everybody wanted to know, well, does that improve survival? And we had ideas that it would probably improve survival by looking at how long it took them to fail therapy. And when you think back, when you give somebody an ARB-targeted therapy in the metastatic state, most of them are going to progress within a year. And here it was about 3 years before they'd be developed resistance. So we already had an idea that earlier did make a difference, and it did turn out to show significant improvements in overall survival, even though the placebo arms were treated much earlier than we would in the real world. So you do not catch up if you wait for even the earliest signs of metastatic disease compared to treating them even before they have visible metastases.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Really clear messages. So going back to the point about, for listeners out there, about how you identify the patients, because for urologists and radiation oncologists, we all have waiting rooms full of patients who've been on ADT for many years. They're coming back every so often. They may be, well, they're getting a little bit older now. Maybe I'll ask you about that, Shankar. This guy with a slightly rising PSA, doubling times a long time, is this current data, this emerging data, changing the way you approach these patients? Are you tightening up perhaps how frequently you're going to look for the PSA? Because all, for listeners out there who manage patients with prostate cancer, there's lots of men in the waiting rooms with rising PSAs. And I think what Fred's just said is we have to identify these early on. So how do you do that? You're going to have to check the PSA.
I think in general, our follow-up patterns, at least locally, are relatively, stringent. We follow patients out for many, many years, and often even 6-monthly PSAs are reasonable in a patient who's had definitive treatment in the past. I guess the population you mentioned, which was like you mentioned, there's 3/4 of patients had prior treatment. There is that population of men who've never had definitive treatment to their prostates, and that population is real as well, because I guess once we're better at managing our medical comorbidities, we're actually surprised by how long men are living, men that you may not have thought would have reached the area of castrate resistance are actually becoming castrate resistant on definitive therapy, on ADT alone. So these two populations of people, of men, are definitely people we should be following up. I'm not sure I can give you a guideline as to the optimal time for follow-up, but certainly it's nice to have these new options available.
And what about imaging, Shankar? I mean, it has such an important role, not just in determining who are the people that are progressing, but also who may be, a good candidate for something like SABR. To an isolated lesion. What's your take on that, and how often do you image patients, and at what point do you image them, and with what?
That's a great question. And I think I'm probably skewed by my practice and where I'm working in Melbourne, and particularly Peter Mac. I think it's going to be different based on where you are regionally as well. To be honest, I think the bit that I should ask all you what your views are, the area I find most challenging is that intraprostatic recurrence in a patient we've done just regular PSAs becoming castrate resistant. All of a sudden we arrange a PSMA PET and it's intraprostatic recurrence. And that man's obviously typically a bit older, might have had prior radiotherapy or no treatment at all to the primary. And the reason for that is that it may have been comorbid at the time. Managing that man is a challenging part. Do we add some other local therapy alongside escalating the systemic therapy at that point? So, I'm going to answer PSMA PET, and that's probably an easy way to go. But what do you do with that PSMA PET?
Yeah.
Nobody's answering the question. That's always a worrying sign, Fred, isn't it? But it's especially rare. You've talked about it before. It was talked about at APCCC. What do you do with this patient with the rising PSA? Novel imaging is showing this very impressive lesion in the prostate, in the untreated prostate. No metastases. Now, clearly, the data, which we want to ask you about, the three trials, and we'll make reference to what's approved in this country and reimbursed. But what about treating the primary if you can see this avid lesion? You might even have re-biopsied it. It's the only site of disease. Never had local treatment. Is there value in locally treating these as well as the systemic treatment that we'll come on to in a second?
Well, it really depends on the biology of the disease. And I think as much as we think PSA is not very useful, it's the most useful biomarker we have. And the biology really is based on the doubling time. So if it's a slow doubling time, I completely agree. That might really be worth treating if it's the only site of disease on PSMA with a slow rising PSA. But a rapidly rising PSA, like you said, every 6 months, every 8 months, I'm not sure there's going to be much help. And there are clinical trials going on. I know you're doing this in Australia. Systemic therapy plus or minus targeted SBRT, which is what we need to do. What I would propose is, you know, you can fault on over-treatment, but don't delay the systemic therapy that has shown to be life-prolonging in a patient with a rapidly rising PSA. So whether or not you treat a lesion that you see on PSMA, that's, you know, that's a tumor board question. But it's a systemic therapy that's a level one evidence that it delays metastases and it improves survival, which is what we want for our patients. And if you wait for them to have metastases, you're shortchanging the patient. We know that those patients won't catch up to the benefit patients get if they start before the appearance of metastases.
Yeah, and sometimes I think with PSMA PET, we can lose our focus a little bit and focus on the primary when in fact it's a systemic disease that will ultimately kill a patient. And so I think it's important not to sway from that focus on these patients. Fred, I wanted to hear your thoughts. So, you know, a lot of patients get PSMA PET very regularly, especially here in Australia. So if you think a patient is a candidate for second-line antiandrogens, should you then go back and do the conventional imaging to make sure they fit the criteria?
Well, I think that's a question that you need to answer here in Australia. I mean, we don't have that luxury. We just don't do PSMA in our center. That is a tick box for exclusion criteria to getting a PSMA. A rapidly rising PSA is a reason not to do a PSMA in our center. And a slow rising PSA is an indication. We're looking for where that, and that there's a risk of helping the patient. So outside of a clinical trial, you just can't get a PSMA in our center. So we're doing the conventional imaging. And to come back to the frequency, if the PSA is starting to rise and you're in the castrate resistant, you know, we're getting PSAs every couple of months. Because if you're getting them every 6 months, it's going to take you a year and a half to calculate the doubling time. If you're getting them every 2 months, you can calculate it within 6 months because you need 3 PSA levels. So if you're continuing to do business as usual every 6 months follow-up, you won't realize they're rapidly rising until about a year and a half or a year. And so that's
a good point, yeah.
So you need to shorten the windows of PSAs once you see that they're starting to rise. And so we talk about personalizing care. It's personalizing follow-up and personalizing to help the patient make a decision.
That's what I do, I must say. Once I see PSAs rising, I usually give the patient a few extra PSA slips saying, you know, I'll catch up with you in 3 months, but do this again in a month and another month and we'll catch up in 3 months. But Louise, can I ask you that question? That's my simple way of doing it, but you're much more used to using PSA doubling time and you're much more advanced patients. What tips do you have for clinicians out there about PSA doubling time? Do you use apps or websites to do this?
Point, Declan, about tailoring the follow-up to what's happening with the patient and the PSA kinetics, because certainly in the castration-resistant setting, if a patient has really stable disease, they're tolerating the enzalutamide really well, sometimes 12-weekly reviews is appropriate, whereas other patients where the PSA is slightly trickling up, sometimes I actually review them 4-weekly just so I keep a really close eye on the PSA, particularly in that situation where when they progress it can be quite rapid. But I usually do always try and formally calculate the PSA doubling time. So there's a couple of good apps. There's the PSA app, that's what it's called, when you literally just put the three or four most recent PSAs in and it spits out a nice doubling time. Unless it's really obvious and you can tell it's obviously doubling within 4 weeks, then you don't need to calculate it.
Is that what it's called? Is that the one that's PSAPP?
I presumed it was PSA app.
You're right.
Combined.
Oh, PSA app. I get it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's on the App Very Store. Good. I think it's a couple of South American urologists put it together.
Oh, right.
It's got PSA density in it as well, actually.
Yeah, that's
handy
right.
for our
yep.
MRI
yeah.
work.
It's really helpful.
Yeah, so I think it's useful and it saves the data so you can just add it in the next time. But
exactly.
So use a tool. Don't just have a guess at it. You know, that's what do you do, Fred?
Well, in doubt, I use the Sloan Kettering. I just discovered this one. So I'll take a look at it. But there are some patients that are very simple. You just go back to find where it was half of that, and then you've ballpark. Basically calculated it. So some of them are clear. It's the ones that are more in the 8 to 10 month range that you need to probably refine it and use one of the apps. Absolutely.
So we want to ask you about the trials, the drugs in particular. Here in Australia, just for audiences, we have the three drugs here available. Only one of them is reimbursed. Darolutamide has been reimbursed only over the past 9 months or so. So this is the one of most impact to us in clinical practice currently. Can you just remind us of the data to support the use of darolutamide in this population?
Yeah, so, you know, so darolutamide is reimbursed, and that's great because, you know, the three drugs are excellent drugs. They all showed very similar time to metastases, very similar but very profound overall survival improvements. And darolutamide is a little bit distinct from the other two AR-targeted therapies because of the preclinical evidence that it probably doesn't get into the brain as much and might explain why we might see less fatigue, but especially less CNS side effects. And so that's very much appreciated by the patients because, you know, we have to admit these are patients that are asymptomatic, that you look at them and you say, you know, something's going on, and they say, well, I feel perfectly fine. Why are you getting me nervous, you know, about your PSA doubling time and rise? And so, you know, it's reassuring that you can maintain quality of life even though you're introducing therapy to a patient who feels perfectly fine, besides the ADT. So they're all starting with some form of discomfort because you're, you know, they're all castrate. But it's important to avoid making it even worse when they're already at a castrate stable state. And it's very reassuring. And the data is very convincing in terms of the primary endpoints, but also multiple secondary endpoints that you delay chemotherapy, you delay symptoms, you delay skeletal events. And so very reassuring, all while maintaining quality of life in those patients.
Yeah, and a question we had for Louise about that then, having identified the patient population, these fast doubling times, M0, just use conventional imaging. We'll come back to that in a moment again. But a question for you, Louise, is it safe for a urologist like me or a radiation oncologist like Shankar to be looking after these patients once we've decided they need systemic therapy, once we just think, okay, we're going to use one of these three drugs?
Because often they, you know, when they've had their primary treatment, they're under the care of the urologist, and some urologists will start ADT, and then they'll just kind of keep that going. Yeah. So at what point should we hand them over?
Well, you're starting with bicalutamide. It can't be that simple.
We can do that.
Similar sounding thing. So.
It's a controversial question, and I'm obviously very biased. But I must say, at Peter Mac at least, the practice generally is that they do get referred to medical oncology, and the trend does seem to be in our institution that the med-oncs prescribe it. But in saying that, I think with people like Fred and Declan and Renu and radiation oncologists like Shankar, you know, I'd be very comfortable with you prescribing it. I think the main thing is, you know, the prescriber has to have the time to follow up the patient and monitor for toxicity and obviously be well informed about what the toxicities will be.
Yeah, that's, would you say the same, Fred? You know, same about anything we use in medicine, really, isn't it? That, you know, obviously, you should be well-informed about initiating something and well-informed in supporting a patient with anything, but
The drugs are easy. It's the patients. Yeah. It's the patients that are complicated. I mean, so you have to be willing to make the time. And what I discourage, because I think urologists clearly can do this, radiation oncologists, but you can't dabble. This is a lethal disease. You don't just dabble in it and do clinics that are, you know, full of patients of all sorts and they fall through the cracks. So, you know, there has to be some dedication to treating these patients. And, you know, getting the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist involved and that you work as a team, because they're going to have to be treated when they're metastatic. They're going to go on to some other treatment. And patients need to understand that this is the first of probably multiple steps until they actually die of the disease. And that's, you know, that's the fact. That we don't cure these patients. And so we need to have a team approach. And whoever starts it is okay. It's the fact that we have to know when it's appropriate to change therapy. And that's what sometimes people forget, is that, you know, there are signals that things aren't going as well and that patients have to be prepared for that.
Fred, I'm interested to hear, you know, all these, when these AR-targeted therapies are started, of course, their ADT is continued. Mm-hmm. Do you see a situation where the ADT can be stopped in the castrate-resistant population?
The simple answer is no.
No.
All the studies have maintained ADT throughout, so we have no data. And it's always the question, we're doing hormonal therapy, why don't we stop the older hormonal? They've become hormone refractory. Why are we continuing the hormone therapy? And that's a misnomer, and it really is important because patients get confused. Sometimes they think they're starting another drug so they can stop the old one. So you have to continuously remind them, are you taking your injections? Don't stop. This is for life. What we do is addition to the baseline. And for now, I would absolutely not recommend stopping the base hormone therapy. Even though testosterone sometimes takes a long time to go up, it starts to creep up. and going from 0.7 to 1.7, you're still castrate, but you see things worsening, and you don't want to be dealing with the castration resistant clones and the castration sensitive clones.
Yeah.
Don't dabble in it. I think that I'll remember that, you know, but if you are interested in the disease area and you care about your patients, it is definitely possible. And industry are very good at supporting us. Key opinion leaders and colleagues are as well. But for me, the most important message about all of this is for those of us who have these patients, we need to learn that lesson about how to identify these patients, because it's such a missed opportunity if just because we weren't aware of it, or we maybe weren't on top of that PSA as it was rising, then we miss out on this opportunity. These drugs are available. It's reimbursed in Australia. So I think that's the message for everyone out there. When you're in clinic tomorrow, that old fellow who's, oh, his PSA is rising a little bit quickly, get on top of it. Give him a couple of extra PSA slips. And don't do a PET scan. I think that's one of the most important things. But Shankar, to ask you about that, we know data that Michael Hoffman at Peter Mac was involved with five other big institutes, including Fred around the world, showed that in this population of men with M0 CRPC, with the fast-rising PSA, if you do a PET scan, almost everybody has disease outside the prostate. So isn't that therefore an important point? Don't do the PET scan. You know there's going to be stuff you're not going to see on conventional imaging. Do you agree with that? Or what is the role of doing PET scans?
I mean, look, the data you're referring to had 98% of the patients having some type of disease, but not all of that was outside of the pelvis. You know, there was about a quarter, I remember, it was within the pelvis itself. So it's not necessarily M1 disease on novel imaging. So I have a bias because we do have a trial here that we do use conventional imaging for called Decrease, which we have an entry of M0 CRPC, which is based on the conventional imaging, and then randomize all the men have PSMA PET scans and randomize to either darolutamide versus darolutamide and consolidation radiotherapy at 3 months. I still use conventional imaging in this group, and I think the use of PSMA PET sometimes raises issues that you don't want to deal with necessarily. Like I mentioned, the intraprostatic recurrence and what to do with that. And we have level 1 evidence, as mentioned, in that M0 CRPC setting.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting about the intraprostatic recurrence. Just to bring it up again as we head towards the close, Fred, because at APCCC, again, we don't have evidence to inform this, so sometimes the APCCC meeting, which is a great meeting, at least has leaders voting on what would you do in clinic with this patient with this. And there was support for local therapy, and well, that's usually radiotherapy to it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's your comment on you're a classic clinical trialist, but what's your comment on using expert opinion like from APCCC to deal with real-world situations where there isn't a trial, there won't be a trial?
No, absolutely. I mean, we're both involved, and all of us were involved at APCCC, and it does give some guidance, but clearly we don't have consensus in many areas, and where we don't have consensus is where we need clinical trials. So this is where APCCC sometimes helps us to define areas where we need to do more work, and I congratulate the team here to be doing that work, because, you know, this is the only thing I wouldn't want is to say you do targeted therapy without systemic therapy with the goal of waiting or delaying systemic therapy. That could be life detrimental for the patient, but I look forward to seeing those results. But in a patient with local recurrence in the prostate, slow doubling time, clearly we do treat if it's safe. Rapid doubling time, it's a clinical trial question, because you have to weigh the pros and cons. I mean, it's not always a walk in the park to get radiation therapy, especially if you've already had it in the past.
And Fred, just before we finish up, you know, we, like we said, we're moving the needle forward, and we're becoming more aggressive in the metastatic hormone-sensitive setting. And, you know, it's great. We've got to give our best drugs up front. But what happens when, I mean, eventually they'll progress, and if we delay progression, then great. But what happens when they get to the castrate-resistant setting and we've exhausted those options?
Well, that's why we're still doing clinical trials. Mm-hmm. You know, and if we didn't prove that we're improving survival by treating early in the patients that are appropriate to get early treatment, then we would have an issue. But we're improving survival.
Yeah.
So that argument of don't do too much up front because you need to do something later down the road is a ridiculous argument against aggressive upfront treatment in a patient who's at risk of dying from prostate cancer. You have to do the very best, because your best chance is the first.
Yeah. Great messages.
I think I've got all the messages. Yeah. Frequent PSA testing. Don't do a PET scan.
Don't dabble.
Don't dabble. That's a good one. Louise, could I finally ask you, is there anything else going on in M0CRPC? I mean, it seems like there's been fantastic progress to get to these three very well-tolerated life-prolonging therapies in the space now, darolutamide reimbursed here in Australia. Is that the end of research interest in M0CRPC now? Or what do you think might be an interesting research area?
With the current theme in prostate cancer is really intensifying treatment, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's, you know, future clinical trials looking at subsequent combinations. I'm not aware of any at the moment. I think the DECREASE trial looking at the addition of SABR will be the next big piece of data that will be interesting. But I guess the other thing is looking at genetic testing, because classically in Australia we only do testing for BRCA when they have metastatic disease. So as soon as these patients progress, that would be our next step as the medical oncologist. But whether or not we start doing that earlier on and introduce PARP inhibitors in this situation for the BRCA mutated patients, that possibly is something we can explore in trials.
Fantastic.
Fred, any last comments from you?
I think like you said, this has been great progress, but unfortunately there are still patients that resist these treatments. So, you know, and you can figure that out quite quickly. You know, the 3-month PSA response when you start an M0 patient, some patients don't get that decline that you're hoping for. And so that, I think, is what we're going to start doing research on. The great responders, I think that's good. It's the ones that are not the great responders. Should we further intensify? Why are they not responding? There's, like you said, biology to understand why some patients don't respond well, even in the non-metastatic.
Yeah.
Superb. That was fun, Renu.
It was.
You enjoyed that?
I did. I learned a lot.
Fantastic.
I'm going to refer everyone to Louise now. And to Shankar. No, I'm not. I'm going to use the app.
Am I a dabbler or am I committed? If I ask myself that question, I don't know. Don't know the answer.
Oh, you're not a dabbler. You do a lot of prostate. Yeah, no, I don't think anybody dabbles in metastatic breast cancer or advanced breast cancer. I think prostate has to realize that we're dealing with men that are going to die of the disease. And, you know, understanding it and referring appropriately is as good as doing it yourself.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. What a great way to finish. Well, thank you very much to Shankar, to Louise, to Fred for joining us on GUcast.
True multidisciplinary panel.
Exactly. And thanks very much to our silver partners, Bayer, for supporting this and for supporting Fred being in town tonight to educate us all. That's all we got time for now. We'll be back again soon. Thank you very much and goodbye.